arguing that such a measure not only had political merit, but it would, in effect, undercut Franco's forces. But they would not. The Spanish government did not. It wouldn't go as far as ending colonialism. In fact, it went further the other way by offering territorial concessions to France and Britain in exchange for Western support, which they really didn't get. The Communist Party of Spain and the PUM, which is the Anti-Stalinist Workers' Party of Unification, believed that an explicit anti-colonial policy might actually foment rebellion within the ranks of Franco's army, but they supported the government's position, and so for the sake of maintaining the Popular Front, they didn't say anything. The Spanish Socialist Workers' Party was outright, we'll never give up the colonies. Like, why call yourself socialists? Like, you know, I'm looking at this. So my point here is that, you know, so many people on the left who are fighting against fascism could not see that the same regime was upholding and maintaining fascism, right, through colonialism. So many international brigaders started calling North African troops, quote, things like the scum of the earth, black riffraff, and mercenaries, to which George Padmore, a black radical, wrote a rebuke in 1938. He says, it seems rather strange that the people who use these epithets conveniently forget that these unfortunate Africans are as much the victims of a social system as Europeans who are forced by sheer economic necessity into the armed forces of the capitalist states and used by the imperialists to shoot down unarmed and defenseless natives in the colonies in the name of democracy and law and order. See, that is the critique right there. Right? So he placed, you know, the blame on the Popular Front government for continuing to hold on to the colonies. And colonialism is precisely what made it possible for Franco to mobilize the army. Okay? In any case, the other thing that Césaire was keenly aware of is that fascism was not defeated at the end of the Second World War. So Césaire explicitly references the atrocities carried out by French occupation forces against the anti-colonial movements in Vietnam and Madagascar after World War II as evidence of fascism's persistence. And I just want to quote, he says, think of it, 90,000 dead in Madagascar, Indochina trampled underfoot, crushed to bits, assassinated, tortures brought back from the depths of the Middle Ages. And of course, when he's talking about Madagascar, he's referring to the massacre of the Malagasy people by French occupation forces in 1947 during the anti-colonial uprising. And you know who was there to help put down the uprising? Troops from Senegal. We have to know this history. So before the publication of Discourse on Colonialism in 1950, post-war anti-colonial and anti-racist movements insisted that the victory over fascism was incomplete. So, some examples. 1945, this is South Africa, 3 years before the Afrikaner-led National Party came to power and imposed apartheid. The non-European unity movement issued a statement arguing that non-white South Africans continue to live, quote, under a tyranny with very little different from Nazism. And by the way, people in government were themselves Nazis. They weren't like pretend Nazis, they were actual Nazis. Many colonial wars broke out around the time of Discourse's publication. Notice I call them colonial wars. I don't want to call them anti-colonial wars. Why is that? Because by calling them colonial wars, it signals that the instigator of the war were not those fighting for their freedom. They didn't instigate the war, right? They assumed their basic right to freedom in this new global order that says you got a right to freedom. So if they fight back, it's because the war had been waged on them before their birth. It had been waged on them from the moment of the colonial domination, right? Algeria, they want to hold on to Kenya. They want to hold on to Vietnam, to the Congo, to Southern Rhodesia, which outlawed all African nationalist parties in the fascist Rhodesian Front a party of settlers won a majority of seats in the legislature when? In 1962. It's the year I was born. 2 years after the Year of Africa. So again, fascists are coming to power, not people who look like or sound like, but declare themselves, right, as part of this fascist movement. And there are many more examples, but none in the post-war period is as striking as the creation of Israel.
You're listening to Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
So Dr. Fayez A. Saeg, renowned scholar and UN rapporteur, observed in 1970 in an essay the incongruity of the creation of Israel and the expansion of consolidation of settler colonialism, quote, in a historical era marked by universal rejection of colonialism in principle and near total liquidation of colonial empires in practice. So that's the irony. It's like, here's like the latest colonial outpost in the midst of a period that's known for decolonization. So that same year, the same year that French occupation forces crushed the uprising in Madagascar, Zionist militias waged a deliberate campaign of terror and expropriation, razing Palestinian villages, taking or destroying their property, and above all, taking their land. And from 1947 in December to July 1949, militias drove more than 800,000 people, that is 80% of the Palestinian population, from their land, destroyed or emptied over 500 villages, demolished homes, setting some homes ablaze, blowing them up, knowing that families were inside. And I'm not going to repeat the story because you all know that story. But it is worth noting two things. One, the leading settler militias, and especially its leader, David Ben-Gurion, claimed to be fighting on behalf of labor. It was a labor party, the Jewish working classes. The workers, so-called workers' state of Israel, passed laws barring Palestinians' right to return or retrieve their property, which is a very unlaborly thing to do. The man who called himself Zionist Lenin wrote in his diary in 1948 that in their war of dispossession, quote, we need to harm Palestinians without mercy, women and children included. During the operation, there is no need to distinguish between guilty and not guilty. That's what's happening right now. Like, the majority of Israelis, Jewish Israelis, have decided that there are no innocents in Gaza, that everyone is good. It doesn't matter. You could be newborn. You're not innocent. And that's what David Ben-Gurion's saying. There's no innocence in our quest to take the land and homes and olive groves and everything. The colonization of Palestine was swift, was violent, it was patently illegal, even by UN standards. And yet, that act of colonization was backed by all Western liberal democracies, those nations that claim to have defeated fascism. Zionism turns the history of Jewish displacement, expropriation, and terror into class rule and colonial violence. So with respect to Palestine, my friend and colleague, Nader Shaloub Kevorkian, who's one of the most brilliant people on the planet, insists that we recognize dismemberment as a critical feature of colonial violence, not just with respect to the literal body, but in separating people from native and ancestral lands, from plant and animal relations, and therefore from culture, the culture, the memory, the life worlds, and ancestors that tie them there. Expropriation, displacement isn't just spiritual death, but literal death. The process of ethnic cleansing, occupation, the transformation of land into real estate creates killing fields. In her essay titled Ashla and the Genocide in Gaza, Livability Against Fragmented Flesh, which I think everyone should read, theorizes the politics of Ashlah, which is Arabic for scattered flesh, a term that she found kids were using in Palestine to describe loved ones, teachers, friends whose bodies were blown to pieces by Israeli bombs and snipers. And she argues that to the colonizer, Palestinian people in Palestine as a whole entity is unthinkable. Their destruction is mandatory. The raison d'etre for Israel's creation as a settler colonial state, not just in whole or in part, but in parts. But Ashlah is also a demand for wholeness, for remembering. She describes breastfeeding women who rushed to the hospital to feed infants whose mothers were turned into Ashlah. She writes, "It is against the production of displaced and shredded corpses that relatives, sons, daughters, fathers, mothers recreate relationships and innovate life. They turn necrophilic settler colonialism upside down when they breastfeed in a genocide," right? Speak of collect, hold, gather, and embrace Ashlah. That is, in some ways, the dead, the shredded. Dismembering and scattering flesh exceeds extermination. It is overkill, intended for display. It is meant, in her words, to mutilate the killed and turn the killed body into mere flesh, unrecognizable as human, to dehumanize them and their bodies. And this is all being live streamed, right? Now, those of us, and there's a lot of black people in this room, know, when you say dismemberment, we know exactly what that means. The necropolitics in the United States is what lynching is all about. It's about dismembering the body. They don't just take a life, and they keep it for souvenirs. Rape is also a form of dismemberment, of gendered racial violence, and an assertion of sovereignty. We see this in slavery, right? And it continues well after. Nadra sees the objective behind Israeli sexual violence to invade and violate the intimacy, sexuality, and bodily integrity of the colonized, right? In the production of these slaughtering zones, sexuality, the body, the dismembered wholeness of the colonized are all determined by the sovereignty of the settler state. So, to end this, the Nakba never ended. The violence never ended. The genocide we are witnessing in Gaza today really began in 1948, and like other forms of settler colonialism, it is an expression of fascism, which means the long Palestinian struggle for freedom and self-determination is both an anti-colonial and an anti-fascist struggle. The last thing I want to talk about is the U.S. So Cesare writes, "I make no secret of my opinion that at the present time, the barbarism of Western Europe has reached an incredibly high level, being only surpassed, far surpassed, it is true, by the barbarism of the United States." Now, some of you may not have gotten to the end of discourse, but that's what he says on page 47. Black radical intellectuals in the U.S. were saying much the same thing, but they argued that fascism was on U.S. soil. So it didn't appear as a boomerang, at least not on the surface, since they were talking about homegrown fascism a la Langston Hughes. They saw the post-war peace as a ramping up of fascism at home. St. Clair Drake, sociologist and noted anti-fascist and co-author with Horace Caton of Black Metropolis, which is about this city. The landmark two-volume study of Chicago's South Side, published in 1946, right? They were saying that this moment when black men who had helped defeat fascism were facing unemployment and an uptick in racist violence, they predicted, and I quote, "The Negro may again become a chronic relief client, despised by the majority of white citizens who have to support him from taxes in the symbol around which the aggressions of a frustrated society can be organized so that he may fill the role of," quote, "the whipping boy for an emerging American fascism." And that's what's happening now, right? Such an outcome could be avoided, they argued, so long as the U.S. achieved full employment in the entire world embrace, in their words, a program for emancipating the common man. The problems arise that arise on Bronzeville's 47th Street encircle the globe. A blow struck for freedom in Bronzeville finds its echo in Chongqing and Moscow, in Paris and Senegal. A victory for fascism in Midwest metropolis will sound the knell of doom for the common man everywhere. So they're saying if fascism continues, this is basically the death of all of us. Now, of course, Drake and Caden were skeptical, to put it mildly. Caden writes this opinion piece in the Pittsburgh Courier in 1945 where he told readers, quote, we told readers that military victory abroad did not mean war against fascism was over. And then he writes, we now turn to the war within our own country. Victory for democracy will mean some chance of a peace. Victory for our own native fascism, the Hitler which lives inside of us, or in the nation, will mean that we're setting the stage for the next world war. And his warning was echoed by black communist Claudia Jones, who argued in 1946 in an article that fascism was alive and well in the Jim Crow South, evidenced in part by the revival of lynching in the beatings and assassinations of black veterans. She observes, today the main danger of fascism to the world comes from the most colossal imperialist forces, which are concentrated within the United States. The perpetrators of these attacks are the representatives of the most reactionary section of monopoly capital and of the semi-feudal economy. Replace semi-feudal economy for Silicon Valley, and basically it's the same thing. Okay, so in closing, whether we continue to use the term fascism, you know, I mean, I'm not mad at you if you do or don't. Most of the modern wars and catastrophes that have displaced like over 123 million people today have roots in the vestiges of the colonial order. And I'm arguing that that order is still with us. People deported or detained, indigenous people across the planet perpetually killed by the state and incarcerated in disproportionate numbers, subject to ongoing dispossession, resource extraction, and the violation of sovereign rights and so forth. And by the way, I live in LA. People don't realize that a lot of the people being picked up, they're almost all indigenous. Spanish is not even necessarily the first language, right? There's 20 indigenous languages spoken in LA alone. And so these are indigenous people who are being picked up and kidnapped, okay? So that's really, really important to realize. If we think of conjunctures, not as singular moments or periods in a unitary world, but rather multiple overlapping concentric circles, which is the way I think about conjunctures, in a combined and uneven world, then we can talk about a very long colonial conjuncture that is still with us now. And that would mean, for those of us who still believe a non-capitalist future is both possible and necessary to save the planet, that there can be no socialism without decolonization. You cannot have socialism without decolonization. And just to circle back, I mean, you take the question of Palestine, in many ways, there is truth in the assertion that Palestine is the last colonial outpost, the last anti-colonial war. However, that implies that the world is decolonized, and this is not true. The fact is, the genocide persists precisely because the colonial order is still intact on a global scale. It just takes on a different form or appearance. So we look for domination through state forms, but often it takes the form of transnational, multinational, and non-national corporate entities that drive and manage global production of commodities. I mean, who are the beneficiaries of genocidal war? Hewlett-Packard, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and the like. So how different are these from the joint stock companies of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, responsible for colonizing Africa, Asia, and the Americas? What is clear, however, is that the unnamed and unacknowledged colonial violence today is arguably more brutal and more pervasive than the era of high colonialism, you know, of the 19th and mid-20th century. In the 21st century, we are living with more violence, more war, more weapons, more lethal capacity, more military bases, more displacement, more land grabs than a century ago. And if you consider, just pay attention to the Eastern Congo, extending to Uganda and Rwanda, with China providing military support for the Democratic Republic of Congo to protect its own investments in cobalt mining. By most estimates, 7 million people have been internally displaced in Eastern Congo. So the boomerang keeps being thrown back, sometimes with even more lethal force. So we can't just celebrate the boomerang hitting the Europeans because they keep throwing it back. You know, and by Europeans, that's not just Europeans. They're also the BRIC countries. We'll talk about that. I didn't plan to talk about that because I've talked about it before, but, you know, be mad at me if you want to. But there's a rearrangement of power, right? It's still a colonial relationship. And despite, like, 85 years of international law, the UN, all these institutions purportedly designed for world peace in a decolonized world, despite all that, nothing has been able to stop the boomerang permanently. So Césaire writes, the hour of the barbarian is at hand, the modern barbarian, the American hour. Violence, excess, waste, mercantilism, bluff, conformism, stupidity, vulgarity, disorder. Right? So I'm saying that we are living in the American hour, not as a rising empire, but a dying one. Stuart Hall calls it iron times. Gramsci calls it an interregnum in which, quote, morbid phenomena of the most varied kind come to pass. Last thing I want to say is I do think that Césaire's conclusion is fundamentally correct, though we must be precise about what he is saying in that conclusion. I'm not going to read it, but I want you to read it yourself, to recognize that he is speaking of the salvation and not redemption of Europe. So just read a short passage. He writes, the salvation of Europe is not a matter of a revolution in methods. It is a matter of the revolution, capital R, the one which, until such times as there is a classless society, will substitute for the narrow tyranny of a dehumanized bourgeoisie, the preponderance of the only class that still has a universal mission because it suffers in its flesh from all the wrongs of history, from all the universal wrongs, the proletariat. By proletariat, he's talking about sort of global, but here he's specifically talking about the European proletariat because he's talking about the salvation of Europe. What is he saying? He says, it is the European proletariat that's key, not because it is the most advanced, right? Not because it controls the most developed productive forces, but because Europe is an invention founded on racial and gender hierarchy, not unlike the Negro, the savage, and so on. Europe needs to be destroyed, right? And by Europe, Europe's not just that, you know, part of Asia. Europe has actually become a global phenomenon. The proletarian revolution, a true one, must rid itself of hierarchies of human, one of the gifts of a decadent bourgeoisie. It is only then that Europe can free itself and join the rest of the world in the class struggle. And this is what he's saying. Of course, that was the hope in 1950 or 55. That time has passed. But we are in a new time, but we're also in an old one. The colonial conjuncture is still with us. And so if we're going to fight and try to build that society, that world, we've got to basically understand that the fight against fascism is the fight against colonialism, is the fight against capitalism, and we can't be parsing out the places that we think we have to respond to in a state of emergency and the ones that we think are friendly to us that have been killing us the whole time. Thank you. One thing, I'm going to answer it with some sort of definitional terms, but also with questions, and I'll be very, very brief. I mean, we have to think of the state certainly as a historical phenomenon, something Stuart Hall talks about, not a thing or unitary structure, but a set of relationships. And of course, state and state forms long predate capitalism. You know, so what we're talking about is a very specific state form or set of forms that come out of the bourgeois democratic state, right? Or the bourgeois state, or there's a colonial state, the colonial state, the liberal state, you know, the fascist state, and all have much in common. So one question, of course, we have to ask, can we actually in 2025 speak of a socialist state? There's never been, as far as I know, a modern state in any society that was not non-carceral. In other words, all states were carceral. And that's one of the things we have to pay attention to. The socialist states of all, they don't abolish the death penalty. They build prisons. And oftentimes, you know, coming out of the left of, in the 60s and 70s, prisons were sometimes celebrated, right? Firing squads were celebrated. You read the Cuban Revolution and what things were happening what's considered revolutionary violence. Of course, we don't think that way, but the context is very, very important. I think the context for states is always important. Let's talk about council democracy. I'm glad you brought this up, because one of the things that is worth thinking about is that we did have moments of council democracy. In other words, it's not a dream. The Soviets, whether you're talking about, you know, in Russia, whether you were talking about in Italy, they existed. Some amazing democratic practices took place in that immediate, you know, revolutionary moment in Russia, where you have Soviets as big as like thousands of people figuring out ways to work cooperatively, to make decisions collectively. And of course, they were crushed. Why? We know in the case of Italy, in the case of the Soviet Union, it's a little different. I think we can speak of state apparatuses that may be distinct, fractured, and have different functions. And here I'm talking about, I guess I'm being a little bit less abstract and thinking about how we actually interact with the state. Like, what does the state actually mean to us? Sometimes it is the DMV, right? Sometimes it is the very structures that distribute goods and services. That's what it looks like. Sometimes it's actually in the form of public education. The fact that the state is highly contested is, I think, worth thinking about. That the fact that the state is fractured and does different things, that means it's not really the state, although in many ways it's all connected. Yes, there's a coercive arm to the state, but coercion also takes the form of law. We often think of the coercive arm of the state just in terms of police, military, the physical presence of violence, but it's also law. And the state that we're looking at now, the so-called deconstructed state, which is not being deconstructed at all, it's just being repurposed, actually is not only making new laws, but has basically kind of abandoned even the pretense of the rule of law. Okay, and the last things I just want to say is that there are lessons to be learned from history. I know. I mean, that's what I do for a living. There are many places for us to plug into different practices and projects that are beyond the state. And I just want to make a plug for one, Sweetwater Foundation, which is right here in Chicago, which is organizing beyond the state, providing food, organic food, skills. They build, they grow, they teach. And they're right here in Chicago. Emmanuel Pratt, Gia Pratt, they're creators. And so there's so many spaces that we cannot abandon in our sort of panic, right? Which we can't panic. You know, if you've watched enough Twilight Zones, you know you can't panic. You know, you have to basically keep straight focus, and that's, I think, what we need to do.
You were just listening to Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. Robin D.G. Kelly, a professor of history at UCLA, is a distinguished scholar and award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Winona LaDuke, Azad Issa, Claudia De La Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Chris Hedges, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robin D.G. Kelly on Colonialism, Capitalism, and Fascism, and for Eduardo Galeano's classic book, Open Veins of Latin America, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk. Bye ya.
Sid Vicious, would you believe it was 42 years ago today that Sid, while he was incarcerated at Rikers, tried to kill himself? He was not successful, and if you know the history of the story of Sid, he was successful a few months later in February of 1979. Before the Gary Oldman track from the Sid and Nancy soundtrack, I went back to 1985's Fables of the Reconstruction from R.E.M., for Old Man Kinsey. Jeremy Ayers actually has a writing credit on there, one of the few songs in the REM catalog that they have a fifth external member or external person get writing credits. He's also on another one of their songs, and he actually, I think, either wrote the lyrics to or has a writing credit on a B-52 song. So he was an Athens scenester. We lost Jeremy a few years back, about 4 years ago, but I wanted to play that for you. And started the entire set, speaking of On This Day, supposedly on this day, back in 1963, Bob Dylan wrote, "The times, they are a-changin'," so I kicked off the entire set with that. But you know what? It's just past 11 o'clock, and I have to do this radio calendar because it's right in front of me, and it's like, Moxter, 11 o'clock, radio calendar. So let's take a look at some things that are happening around town. Maybe around campus? I don't know. Let's figure it out. Off-Root Art wants you. Off-Root Art is actually a nonprofit building a new type of arts community where they connect the public with original art made by artists from ages 16 to 24. Offrootart.com is their website. And the second Saturday of every month, they actually have a themed virtual trivia night. Also, don't forget about the East End Community Thrift Store, because it needs your support. It's just one door down from the Thomas Merton Center. The thrift store has clothing, furniture, and household appliances. Donations, volunteers, and shoppers are all welcome. And all the profits from the store are donated to the Thomas Merton Center to help fund their general operations. The thrift store is located at 5123 Penn Avenue in Garfield. You can also call them up at 361-6010. Whew, geez, you'd think I'd figure these things out. What else do I know? What else? Oh, Pittsburgh Banjo Club. It's on my calendar. Not sure if it's going on, but it's Wednesdays at 8 at the Allegheny Elks Lodge on the north side. Where else can you sit around with a bunch of banjos and sing along? And it's free. They usually have concessions and there's sing-alongs. And you don't have to play. You don't have to be a member of the club. You can just come and observe. So if you have not done that, again, I've said this more than once, it should be on your I Live in Pittsburgh, 100 Things to Do Before I Die, is go to the Pittsburgh Banjo Club. So that's my WRCT radio calendar. If you have an event to include on this calendar, you can send them to radio-calendar@wrct.org. You can hear the calendar each and every day at 1 p.m., 7 p.m., and again, just like you did now, right around 11 p.m. Jay Thurber will give you the calendar with his own take on it tomorrow at 1 during Radio 9. Let's get back into more music, though. It is a music show, not a talk show. It's the Birds. It's Viva Lamont.
Hey there, Viva Les Mocksters. I'm Amanda Richard, encouraging you to enjoy whiskey before breakfast. Not literally. I don't want you getting DUIs. I mean, catch my WRCT radio show, Whiskey Before Breakfast, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on the 88.3 FM Pittsburgh and WRCT.org. Folk, bluegrass, country, blues, and lots more. Oh, don't let the Mocksters hit back fool you. He loves pedal steel guitar as much as he loves the theremin.
Guitars, Cadillacs, hillbilly music. twisted lines, painted scars, all left me. Oh, but thank you, girl, for teaching me brand new ways to be cruel. If I can find my mind now, I guess I'll just leave.
That's the birthday boy, Dwight Yoakam, here on the Viva La Mock radio program. Yeah, it's his birthday today as well. Not just Weird Al's. 64 years old today, Dwight Yoakam. Took that from his 1986 debut title track, Guitars, Cadillacs. Before that, Beat Farmers in there went back to their 1985 debut as well. With Never Going Back. Gladys from Lexington, Kentucky, doing the Kentucky State song, My Old Kentucky Home, which ironically, conveniently, historically, was written by Pittsburgh's own Stephen Foster. Let's start off the entire set with Birds, some Birds, Turn, Turn, Turn. A song that is celebrating, let me get the math right, 55 years. My name's Paul. It's a show called Viva La Mock. I always appreciate when you find some time to come hang out with me on a Friday night. I do want to let you know that Circadian Rhythms are a waking nightmare Sundays at 5 here on WRCT. And I also need to let you know that Color Perfect Printing joins you in supporting WRCT. Color Perfect Printing is a full-service print shop located at 804 Penn Avenue in the heart of the Cultural District downtown. They offer high-quality color printing for posters, flyers, art prints, die-cut stickers, vinyl lettering, so much more. They specialize in graphic design and soft-bound books for self-published authors and artists. Check out their website at colorperfectprinting.com to request an estimate. Let Color Perfect's knowledgeable staff help you speak in color and obtain that professional look and finish for all of your printing needs. One more. How about maybe not? Anyway, if you've got a request, all you have to do is reach out to me via an email, and I will play your request on a future show. The request line via that email is wrctrequest@gmail.com. Speaking of requests, I did get a request for some Luna. So this is Dean Wareham's second appearance in the Viva La Mock radio program tonight as I played some Galaxy 500. Here's his anti-Galaxy 500 song from Luna's debut, Luna Park. It's Slash Your Tires right here on the Viva La Mock radio program. Don't forget, we got a Johnny Carson mock coming up at midnight. Today would have been his 95th birthday. Speaking of birthdays, Johnny Carson mock. Midnight.
seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is, oh yes he is, oh yes he is, oh yes he is. Thinks he is a flower to be looked at, and when he pulls his frilly nylon and his raked up tights, he feels a dedicated follower of fashion. He loves, and that is flattery. One week he's in polka dots, the next week he's in stripes. But he's a dedicated follower of fashion. They seek him here, they seek him there, in Regent Street and Leicester Square. Army marches on, each one a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
His world is built round discotheques and parties. His pleasure-seeking individual always looks his best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Shop just like a butterfly. In matters of the cloth, he is as thick as can be, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. He's a dedicated follower of fashion. He's a dedicated follower of
breakfast as well. That's the why I am. Heaven help me. He said, don't.